Right. Good afternoon, members and viewers. I'd like to call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. First order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you could please take the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Backlund.
Backlund, present.
Backer.
A Backer, present.
Bonner.
Bonner, present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dingeth.
Present.
Freiberg. Freiberg. Grunhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor. Pryor. Kwan.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamont. A quorum is present.
All right. Representative Ms. Niedernhofer. Representative Freiberg is here. And I understand that Representative Wolgamont is going to be just a little bit late, so he'll be joining us. And then Representative Pryor, if she is able to get on, we'll note her as well when she does. So, all right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. So the next order of business is a motion on the minutes.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I am here. I am unmuted now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Your presence is noted. Representative Quamp.
I have reviewed the minutes, Madam Chair, and would move to approve them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quamp. Moves approval of the minutes of March 1st. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing no discussion, if you would unmute yourselves, members, just for a moment. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Quam. So first on our agenda this afternoon, we have a budget update from Dave Greenman from the Department of Human Services. Mr. Greenman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I think you asked for a forecast briefing. I can, I think one of my, Mr. Burdick can put the document up on the screen. I can walk through the forecast for the, the February 2021 forecast. I think the major, so what this document is basically a nutshell showing the major movement in the expenditures for various programs and the reasons why. It's a two-page document. I won't go through the whole thing, but I thought I would just cover some high-level information and stand for questions. The major message from this forecast for DHS spending is that spending is going down, continuing to go down in the current biennium, and then also in the next biennium as well. It does rise in fiscal years 24 and 25, or it's projected to rise in fiscal years 24 and 25. And I can go through a little bit of detail about the reasons why. Most of the reduction in fiscal years 20 and 21 have to do with lower caseloads for the CCAP program, child care assistance program. The caseload's down about 18% from what we projected in the November forecast. We're also seeing a higher federal share for CCAP payments that combined those two factors account for about 65% of the reduction in fiscal years 20 and 21. The reduction in fiscal years 22 and 23 is driven almost completely by the assumption in the forecast that the public health emergency, the federal public health emergency, would be extended through December of 2021. And that's based on a letter that governors received from the acting Secretary of Health and Human Services back in January, indicating that it was likely that it would last that long. That extension results in an extension of the period in which we receive an additional 6.2% increase in our medical assistance federal matching rate, which results in actual reduction in state spending of approximately $474 million in fiscal years 22 and 23. That is, in order to qualify for that enhanced FMAP, we need to maintain continuous coverage as required under federal law and meet federal requirements for maintaining that coverage. In order to do that, we incur costs of about $162 million, which over the 22-23 biennium, which offsets that that savings. So the net impact to the general fund of extending the public health emergency is about $312 million in reduced expenditures. In fiscal years 24 and 25, we see a growth, a net growth in general fund spending, mainly due to increased average costs for disability waivers. For all four of the disability waivers, we're seeing cost increases of about 2.4 to 2.5%. And that's resulting in costs increasing in 2004, 2005 of about $109 million in our disability waiver spending. Just going down the document a little bit, you can see there's some reduction in nursing home spending, lower average costs for nursing home spending that grows over time. And this is because we changed the way we project how nursing home rates are going to increase. In the past, we looked at the beginning of the year, because we use cost-based reimbursement, we looked at their cost of care reports at the beginning of the year, and we based our growth on those cost of care reports. However, what we notice is that over the course of a year, those reports get adjusted downward. And so we've built that into the forecast. And so that's showing a reduced growth in nursing home spending. In fact, for fiscal year, or for 2021, we're projecting a 5.8% growth instead of a 6.6% growth, which was what we had in the November forecast. We're also looking at a slight decrease in recipients' caseloads for nursing homes and intermediate care facilities. For long-term care waivers, just a couple things in addition to the higher average costs that I would note. We do have built into this forecast increased spending for day services. And that's the item labeled COVID amended executive orders. This was when the pandemic first started, the commissioner placed significant restrictions on day services, particularly in congregate settings. And over time, as safety measures have grown, those restrictions have been reduced or relaxed. And just before the forecast came out, she further relaxed those restrictions on day services. And as a result, we project some increased spending in day services going into the future. We still expect a reduction from the pre-pandemic levels, but we expect utilization to go up slightly from what we'd originally projected. We also are seeing a slight decrease in the PCA caseload, and there's not a lot of change in the MA elderly and disabled basic care. It's largely due to the public health emergency. There is some increase in federal or reduction in federal Part D clawback payments, and that's largely because of the higher FMAP rate that we receive. The feds clawback less spending. We are seeing, particularly in 24 and 25, we are seeing a growth in enrollment for or increased projections and enrollment for MA for adults without children and families with children. And essentially what this is we think we over projected a reduction in utilization in the November forecast, and we're just adjusting for it slightly. So we're showing increased spending relative to what we had in the November forecast, where we cut utilization quite a bit because of what we were seeing due to COVID. We're just sort of putting some of that back in this forecast. Moving on to the non-MA programs. There's continuous reductions in utilization for the chemical dependency fund due to COVID, particularly in both residential and non-residential services. For the Minnesota Family Investment Program, we're seeing higher general fund spending, and that's largely due to the fact that because childcare assistance spending is going down, we're spending less general fund on childcare. And we need to meet our maintenance of effort requirement for the TANF program, which funds MFIP. And so we need to increase general fund spending on MFIP in order to meet the TANF MOE requirement, which is why you're seeing a $24 million increase in the current biennium. And then under childcare assistance, you can see the reduction in spending due to COVID, the $26.6 million. There's a number of, most of the other reductions are very small. When you get down to the healthcare access fund, there's essentially two offsetting changes in this forecast. The first one has to do with an interface problem that we had between our MMIS claims payment system and our METS eligibility system, the interface between the two. The problem we had was that adults or parents were erroneously being placed into the rate cell for adults without kids. And adults without kids have a higher PMAP rate. They get a higher, plans get a higher payment rate for adults than they do for parents. And we were seeing that increase in adults relative to parents. And so in the November forecast, we projected growth in that spending. And then what we discovered and have since started to fix is noticing that that was actually an error, that we shouldn't have been putting those people into the adults category. So we've moved them back to the parents category. And so relative to the November forecast, as you can see in 22 and 23, and then 24 and 25, we're saving about $25 million a year relative to the November forecast by adjusting for where these folks should actually go, which is in the parents category. That's somewhat offset by, or more than offset in some cases, by changing in the timing in which we are reconciling with the federal government for payments that we receive through the basic health plan. The state receives quarterly payments from the federal government based on projected enrollment, and we eventually settle up with the federal government where we are able to, we need to show what our actual enrollment was compared to what we projected. And then there's a settle up at that point. And we've been behind in settling up. We're caught up now to 2017. We've been waiting to get a new data mart system set up so that we can continue to reconcile with the federal government. And we have been, and now we're able to move ahead more quickly than we had in the past. And so that means we're reconciling more quickly, and so we're catching up more quickly. And there, because of some, again, the data interface problems between METS and MMIS, we're not able to account for everybody who's enrolled in our program and to satisfy the federal government. And so our BHP payments are being adjusted downward each time we do a reconciliation. And so what you're seeing is earlier reconciliations, and eventually in 2024, we'll be completely caught up and we won't be continuing to have to reconcile each quarter. We won't be catching up in a sense, we'll be current. So those two effects offset each other. And the healthcare access fund balance is projected to be about $184 million at the end of a positive balance of $184 million in fiscal year 23 and have a zero balance at the end of fiscal year 25. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Greenman. Okay. So I don't see any questions. Oh, yes, I do. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And during your discussion, you were talking about decreased participation. A lot of the deaths have been in long-term care and older citizens that might be on the program. And I was just, and you can give that offline to the committee. I was just curious of what the decreased impact of participation is coming from that. Wondering which programs are affected and how by the thousands that have died. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Quam. And you know what, maybe we'll defer that particular question. Is, as you all notice, a lot, this is the budget forecast for DHS. A lot of it is in our committee, the public programs like the MA and so on. But this is a larger conversation, and I think it would be great if Mr. Greenman would get us some more detail on that, off of this particular hearing, but I think that would be important for members to have. Let's see, Representative Grinhagen and then Damon.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a question on the basic health program with Minnesota Care. So if I heard you correctly, the fund is going to, at one time Minnesota Care was being funded by the federal government at 90 cents on the dollar, or about 90% of all the costs. I remember that in the past. So is the federal government adjusting their subsidy of the Minnesota Care program? Or why are we seeing a dramatic drop in the next few years in terms of funding for Minnesota Care?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think there's a number of reasons. I don't think there have been some changes to the federal formula for funding the basic health plan, which has affected the amount of revenue coming into Minnesota. That's been one factor that is affecting the balance. We have also had some other changes that affect how much revenue we receive. The reinsurance program affects revenue to the basic health plan because the amount of funding the state receives to the basic health plan is dependent on what people would have paid in the private insurance market. And as premiums are reduced, then that reduces the federal payments. But there are other factors too affecting the healthcare access fund in general. I mean, there are a lot of things being spent out of the healthcare access fund. MA is being funded out of the healthcare access fund. There's other things as well. So there's a variety of factors, I'd say, that are affecting the balance of the healthcare access fund.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. We're going to take one more question from Representative Demuth, and then we're going to move on. I think we could take, this is another one that is a much more expansive discussion, I think. And today the idea was just to give us a brief overview of what the budget forecast has shown us. Representative Demuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question for Mr. Greenman. Thank you for the overview. In the area that you talked about, the miscategorization that happened with adults with children actually being put into the category for adults without children, can you tell me how long that miscategorization was happening? When did it go back to? And then how long before that is corrected?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, The error was discovered almost right away. It happened in March of 2020. It was discovered almost right away, and a fix was put in place in September into the system to correct for the error. But unfortunately, the error was not picked up in the forecast. And so the forecast erroneously put the wrong people into the different case mix levels. We're working right now to look at how we would, recover those funds, recover funds that have already been paid. But so the adjustment would be looking back from September back to March, and so it's been corrected at this point. So we're going forward, we're in good shape. I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
Thank you,
Representative Dana. Okay. All right. So I think it seems like it's more of a problem of how it shows up in the forecast than an actual problem of funding going where it shouldn't go or being lost where it shouldn't go or something like that. Is that kind of accurate, Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. So thank you very much, Mr. Greenman. We appreciate that update. So we're going to move on to our first bill, and that is House File 1183, the first engrossment. So Representative Stevenson is here. So on his behalf, the chair will move that House File 1183, the first engrossment, be re-referred to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And I understand that Representative Stevenson has an A3 author's amendment. Representative Stevenson, did you want to move that right now?
I would defer to the chair. Happy to do it now or happy to do it after I describe the bill. It's entirely up to you.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, let's just adopt the amendment, and then you can describe the bill as amended. That's usually the most efficient way to do it. So the chair will move the A3 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it heard. And if you could unmute yourselves, members, we'll just take a voice vote on that. And all in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Stevenson, please go ahead and present the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, as members of this committee are acutely aware, the high cost of prescription drugs is just an incredible problem. You know, as members of the legislature, you talk to a lot of people and you hear a lot of stories, but among the most memorable conversations, whether it happens out when you're out door knocking or when you're talking with a constituent in your office, are those with people who are struggling to afford the drugs they need to live. And I think all members here have had those conversations, and they really break your heart. No one should have to choose between paying the mortgage and paying for their children's medication. No one should have to pick between skipping a meal or skipping a pill. But people in Minnesota make those decisions every day. We all know that prescription drug market is complex. And while we wish there was one silver bullet to solve the problem, this is more of a case where we need silver buckshot. And I know a lot of members on this committee have a lot of bills that get at this problem, whether it's Representative Morrison's Farmer Accountability Board, Representative Bierman has a great bill we heard in the Commerce Committee last week, Representative Liebling, you have a great bill that we heard in Commerce the other week, and they're all good steps forward. The bill I'm presenting today is still another piece of the puzzle, addresses situations where prescription drug prices are high, not because of the free market, not because of research and development costs, but because of greed. And we've all seen the stories in the news media about bad actors raising the price of life-saving drugs by shocking amounts overnight. When a pharmaceutical company does that, when they raise the price of a drug that's been on the market for years by 500%, it isn't because it suddenly became 500% more expensive to make the drug. It's because someone somewhere realized that people who take that drug need it to live would pay anything to get it. That's price gouging. It's wrong, and it should have consequences. Members might know that I work as a prosecutor when the legislature's not in session, and I believe in accountability. That's all this bill is about. We're not saying that all pharmaceutical companies are bad actors. Far from it. You don't need to look far these days to see the good work that pharmaceutical companies are doing. They can work miracles. But this is a case where the Spider-Man rule comes into play. With great power comes great responsibility, and a handful of bad actors are abusing that power. One last note. This isn't the first time the legislature has considered similar legislation. Indeed, a very similar bill passed the House last biennium. This bill, however, is different in a material way. It applies only to generic or off-patent drugs, where last year's bill applied to all drugs, and that change is due to a federal court decision. I think the decision is unfortunate. I'm hoping it's being reviewed and reversed. I'm hoping it will be reviewed and reversed. But I generally think complying with federal law is a good idea. And so I'm supporting this narrower approach this year, given the current legal landscape. As I said before, this isn't a silver bullet. It's one piece of the puzzle. And with that, Representative Chair Liebling, I believe there are some testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson. We appreciate that. So on my list, the first testifier is Dawn Bernfin. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead.
Hi, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Dawn Bernfin and I live in Chisholm. I'm a home health care provider and an executive board member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent over 40,000 workers around the state and we support House File 1183. And my story about the high cost of drugs is about my daughter, Emily. She was uninsured and started not feeling well. And so, of course, she called mom. Mom said, you need to go in and be seen. She did not have insurance, so she went to urgent care. And she wound up, you know, they gave her, you know, a dose of antibiotics at urgent care and said, here's a prescription for some medicine. You need to take this and you'll be fine. And since she did not have insurance, she could not afford the antibiotics and the other medicines that they prescribed. It was about $375. Young kid, about 20 years old. She didn't have $375. Mom did not have $375. And so even the the generic form of those medicines, it was still out of reach for her and I both. And so, you know, she started to feel a little better with that one dose from the urgent care. But it wasn't enough to really take care of everything. So she started to get sick again and she got worse and it got so bad that she couldn't even walk. So she wound up in the ER. And, you know, this kind of cycle just repeated itself because she just couldn't afford simple antibiotics and some other things to just clear up what was wrong with her. You know, it's just insane. You know, she'd go back to work, you know, the same thing would happen. And, you know, it just, several of these cycles later, she winds up basically with thousands of dollars in debt. She just simply couldn't afford to fill these prescriptions that they weren't, you know, something to make her feel good. They were life-saving medications. She could have died. She could have wound up not being able to have children, you know, and now she's, you know, this isn't, she racked up a bunch of credit card debts being dumb. This was, she was trying not to die, and she has thousands of dollars in debt. She got another bill in the mail today saying, you owe us money. You know, when she, you know, when she finally got insurance, she was able to go in and be seen, and everything was taken care of, and thank God she was fine. But she was in severe pain for almost a year, you know, and this could have been avoided if some simple drugs were available at a reasonable price. And I want the government to stop companies from being able to charge desperate people as much as they can. Drug companies will not stop squeezing people like Emily until you give someone the power to stop them. This is why I urge you to support this bill. And I had my physical today, yay. And I just realized, you know, when they give you your slip of paper that has all your prescriptions on it, I take 13 prescription drugs, and they're all necessary medications. I couldn't afford them if I had to pay out of pocket. And I looked at the price on the sheet from the pharmacy when I filled them, and it's like they have gone up. And they're all, 11 of the 13 of them are generic forms of the medications that I take. Okay. And I'm going, it's insane.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Burfin. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Brett Michelin, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Brett Michelin. I'm with the Association for Accessible Medicines, and AAM represents the makers of generic and biosimilar pharmaceuticals. And we are opposed to this bill, and as the author mentioned, it is limited to generic drugs or off-patent drugs. And truly, we appreciate the conversations we've had with him, but truly generics and use of and increasing use of generics is the best answer to reducing the cost of drugs. Generic drugs are not what is driving the increase in the cost of drugs. In fact, 90% of all prescriptions are filled with a generic drug, but only 20% of the total revenue is paid for that 90% of prescriptions. Use of generic drugs saved Minnesota $4.5 billion in 2019 alone, and in the US, $313 billion. By contrast, biologic and specialty drugs are only 2% of all prescriptions, yet they're 50% of the costs. This bill will not impact that at all. The promise of the use of bios or increasing the use of biosimilars also will potentially lead to over $100 billion in savings in the U.S. From 2014 to 2019, changes in brand prices led to an increase in $21 billion increased revenue for the brand companies. On the contrast to that, changes in generic prices actually led to $7 billion in decreased revenue. In California, the state that many of the transparency laws that were mentioned that Minnesota has also seen, is probably the furthest along. And in their report from the insurers alone, the 25 most expensive generic drugs, so all out of all generic drugs that are out there, the 25 most expensive drugs result in only, are about 25%, also 25% of all prescribed drugs, but yet they're less than 8% of the total annual spend on drugs, and insurers could only attribute less than 1% of premiums to the 25 most expensive generic drugs that are out there. An AARP study done by Dr. Schondelmeyer, who you're all very familiar with, found that generic prices have decreased by 9.3% in 2017 for the 390 most commonly used generics for senior citizens. The Kaiser Health Foundation, they found that healthcare spending for generic drugs is approximately 3% of total healthcare spending. For brands, it's 10%. For inpatient and outpatient hospital, it's 62% of the healthcare spending. Yet this bill is focusing solely on generic drugs. And we believe that that focus is simply misplaced. There's other aspects to the bill that we oppose as well that could actually, and it's not the author's intent, but could actually increase the cost of drugs, including a private right of action that's been included, and also requiring drug manufacturers to register agents and maintain offices within the state. One last point I would like to raise is this bill was first passed in Maryland in 2017. The Association for Accessible Medicines did bring a lawsuit against that bill that's very similar to this, and it was found unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals based on violation of the Commerce Clause. Because the way the generic drug industry works, we sell 90% of all prescription drugs to three wholesalers. After that, the generic manufacturer is largely out of the pricing game. We have no control over where a particular manufacturer's drug goes. That's all done by the wholesalers, and any additional cost increase after we sell are controlled by the rest of the supply chain. In the House,
Mr. Michelin, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
Absolutely. I just want to address real quickly two issues that have been brought up that the Attorney General brought up in the Commerce Committee. He raised
Mr. Michelin, you're over time. I'm going to give you 30 more seconds if you can.
Perfect. I appreciate that. Cost of Prozac that was raised. One manufacturer raised its cost. There's 38 manufacturers of the exact same drug. The costs range from $790 to $1.61. Wholesalers purchase based simply on price and who can deliver the supply. So just because one manufacturer might increase the price, there are still plenty of others within the competitive marketplace that are still offering the drug at a significantly reduced price. So that price, you can cherry pick a drug in a particular manufacturer, but that does not necessarily mean that's the cost of the drug, because there are multiple manufacturers of the same thing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michelin. All right. We've got some questions. All right. We've got some questions from members. So let's see. I think we're first going to Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Stevenson, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate it. My question is for Mr. Michelin, and it's simply that if there is no reason to question the pricing of generics and biosimilars, I don't understand what your objection to this bill would be. Because it does seem to be a protection for people. And I would just like to hear, because that feels like a disconnect to me.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I appreciate the question. And the opposition really comes down to the impetus that it could put on manufacturers in the marketplace. The more that is placed on them, and the fact that this is unconstitutional, there's a lot of the aspects of the pricing game that we have no control over. So again, once a bill is a drug is sold to the wholesaler, we're no longer part of the pricing, but yet that's what often will be increased down to the patient level. And by putting this type of bill into law, it creates that kind of a disruption within the marketplace, where instead of having 38 manufacturers for Prozac, you might end up with significantly fewer making that drug. And that's where, once you start eroding the direct competition, when you get down to a single manufacturer again, the potential for the price to go up.
Okay. Representative Ryer, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that seems like an awful lot of hypotheticals, but not something that's really happened. So,
okay. Thank you. So we have Grunhagen and then Ackland. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my comment or question is for Representative Stevenson. You know, Representative Stevenson, I just like you to think through this a little bit. I find this bill is well-intended, okay? But I do find I'm in agreement with a lot of the concerns brought up by Mr. Michelin. Put yourself in the position of being a distributor of generic drugs, which again are some of the cheapest drugs that are on the market right now. And so if I bring additional drugs into Minnesota, I would actually be faced with penalties if I were to withdraw it and replace it with something cheaper or more effective down the road. That's going to mean, I think you're going to see less drugs available in Minnesota, coupled with the fact that there's a lot of additional cost for a distributor here in Minnesota, and that's going to increase generic prices even more. So I think your intention is good, and God knows I've sold health insurance since 1978, and I've had people crying over the cost of their prescription drugs, okay? So I do empathize with this. But I just see your bill having a series of negative consequences of less drugs available for people and actually producing higher costs. So I just want you to think that through, what the negative ramifications are, and that this government coming into the market, whether through the Attorney General or some of these laws, actually going to produce more negative consequences for our citizens than positive. Any thoughts on that?
All right, so I'm going to go to Representative Stevenson, but I do have to say that I know Representative Stevenson quite well, and I can assure you, Representative Grinhagen, that he has thought through his bill. So I don't think there's any need to assume that he has not. Representative Stevenson, do you want to respond briefly? We have three more members, and then we're going to try to give you a final word, and then we'll go to a vote. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grinhagen, you know, I think that sometimes when people behave poorly, there should be accountability. And when price gouging occurs and people are trying to take advantage of people who are in a desperate situation, that's wrong, and there should be accountability for that. That's what this bill is about. And I just want to assure you, when you talk about being worried that people won't be able to withdraw drugs in order to bring in a cheaper alternative, that's not at all consistent with the bill. There's nothing in the bill that would stop someone from withdrawing a drug to bring in a cheaper alternative.
All right, thank you. So we have Auckland, Bolden, and Bonner, and then we're going to give a final word to Representative Stevenson, and then we're going to go to a vote. Representative Auckland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment here to Mr. Michelin, and I so appreciated his statistics on how many drugs are generic. 90% are generic, but only 20% the cost of the prescription, because it's always been in my mind, and I've asked the question and didn't get a clear answer until today, that really the people who struggle so often are the people who have the expensive outliers. And that outlier may be $100, it may be $250, or it may be that $10,000 a month prescription that they can't afford. And I've heard even up to $25,000. So the biologics apparently are 50% of the cost. And so as I think about a bill to help us really make medicines affordable, generics typically would be affordable for most of us. Maybe not all, but most of us. And I think it's these biologicals that are out. So I would like to see the bill really address those really strong outliers rather than the generics, because I think those are, maybe we're could make a bigger impact for people who truly cannot afford those expensive pills or biologics, which most of us couldn't. So that's what I'd like. And just Mr. Michelin, do you have any comment about that?
Well, no, Representative Auckland, I'll call on people. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have more of a comment rather than a question. I just wanted to briefly thank Chair Stevenson for bringing this bill forward, and wanted to reframe a little bit and put focus back on who I think is the intended beneficiary of this bill, which is the patient and families who are working really hard in really difficult times and are not able to pay for the life-saving drugs that they need. I can tell you that as a nurse at the bedside in my time, I cared for many patients who were in the hospital because they could not afford the drugs that they needed, or they were rationing drugs that they needed, and had many very difficult conversations with patients upon discharge, knowing that they were going to be leaving the hospital with a prescription that they weren't going to be able to afford, or you know, weren't going to be able to keep up long term. So this is very much needed, and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill forward. You know, let's be really clear about this bill. We are not talking about the 80 to 90% of folks out in the marketplace who are acting in good faith. That's not who we're talking about in this bill. We are clearly talking about the folks who are not acting in good faith, who are deliberately charging outrageous prices for generic drugs that may or may not have been on the market for a long period of time. And we've suddenly seen increases of 100, 200, 300%, even 1,000% has happened before. That is what we were talking about here today. I know Mr. Michelin mentioned that we're talking about worries about drawing down competition and things like that, but let's be really frank and clear with the public here. In many cases, what happens is that large manufacturers are in fact buying up smaller competitors and deliberately taking them out of the marketplace so that there is no competition, which means that they can charge whatever they want, whenever they want. That is how it works. I saw this happen in many industries, but it is very blatant in some cases here, including in the pharmaceutical industry. And so I just want to be clear that when we're talking about we might erode competition, that's actually happening today. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of having to step in as a member of the legislature to regulate companies. I don't really think that's the greatest place that we want to be. But I think here's the problem, and Representative Stephenson brought this to the forefront. With great privilege comes great responsibility. And if these organizations cannot and will not rein in these excesses and do so on their own, then as legislators, as the people whose job it is to protect our citizens, then we are forced to act instead. And quite frankly, I think that's unconscionable. We are clearly talking about the folks who are not acting in good faith. And for those who are acting in good faith, they should have nothing to fear from this bill and nothing to fear from this legislature.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Stevenson, final word on the bill before we vote?
Well, Madam Chair, I will be brief because we've had a really excellent conversation in this committee. I've been really enjoyed some of the comments, you know, Representative Bolden bringing that practical experience from her healthcare experience. Representative Ryer pointing out the disconnect between saying, boy, we would never, ever, ever do this, but please, please don't pass a law saying we can't. And of course, Representative Bonner thoroughly describing the healthcare market. The last thing I would say is this bill is about, if I want to leave one picture in this committee's mind, it would be that in 2015, the famous, infamous pharma bro, Martin Shkreli, who raised the price of Daraprim, a life-saving drug to do HIV and AIDS, 5,000% overnight. He didn't do that because it got 5,000% more expensive to make the drug. He did it to make money. That's wrong, and he should be held accountable for it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Stevenson. So I will renew my motion that House File 1183, First Engrossment as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll on the bill, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
No.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Damoth, no.
Damoth, no. Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg, yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Grinhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Nay.
Quam, no. Representative Breyer.
Breyer, aye.
Breyer, aye. Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Madam Chair, there is 11 ayes and 8 nays.
There being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1339, Representative Pinto. And the motion here, Representative Pinto's motion will be for the bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So Representative Pinto, you are on.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. House File 1339 is a proposal that relates to a study that's being run in our city, in my city in St. Paul and other cities around the country to find out about the impact of supporting families with brand new babies and new children. And for the purpose of that study, we want to make sure that the payments that are received under that will not cause both problems for the families receiving those payments in terms of other programs, and also want to make sure the study can actually work. And so wouldn't want to have it be that if their income payments go up and on one side would go down on the other. And so the payments simply, or the program bill, pardon me, simply provide for an exclusion for income and assets for purpose of this guaranteed income demonstration project. And I should note that there is some precedent for this, precedents for this and some other programs as well. I have, I believe, just one testifier, Madam Chair, and I'll be eager to talk about the bill.
All right, very good. And just members, of course, Representative Pinto is not on the committee, so it'll be my motion. Sorry about that. I see him on the Human Services Committee, and sometimes I just can't remember which screen I'm looking at. So. All right, so we have, Representative Pinto, is there an amendment? There is an amendment, is there not?
There is, Madam Chair, yes, my apologies. Okay. Yes, there is an amendment, that is correct.
All right.
Just trying to bring that up here, but yes.
Shall we move the amendment first, or? Okay.
If you would, I think that would be good, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, so the chair will move the A1 amendment. And does the amendment need explanation, Representative Pinto, or is it technical?
I think, Madam Chair, I believe that it is simply technical. I'm just getting my brain back up to speed here, but as I recall, it is simply a technical amendment.
Okay.
I'm just verifying that. Yeah, it looks like it is in consultation with the department.
Okay, very good. So. Members, so the chair is going to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it discussed. So unmute yourselves, please. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So we'll go to the testifiers. So the first testifier is Munir Karcher Ramos. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Munir Karcher-Ramos. I am the Director of the Office of Financial Empowerment with the City of St. Paul. I'm before you today to testify in support of this bill to provide an income and asset exclusion to preserve families' public benefits as a result of participating in an 18-month demonstration project and research study. The research study is being conducted by the University of Pennsylvania in over 30 cities across the country to look at the impacts of guaranteed income on different indicators of poverty reduction and economic well-being. In the city of St. Paul, this looks like 150 families with young children receiving $500 a month in income support for 18 months So the researchers in our study will be focused also on looking at the impacts of early childhood in addition to economic indicators. The main point of this bill is to prevent families from having their public benefits adversely impacted by their participation in the demonstration project and national study. The state legislature has previously supported income and asset exclusions for a comparable demonstration project and research study. Back in 2016, the legislature provided Columbia University's Baby's First Year study with an income and asset exclusion for child care assistance program, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, medical assistance in Minnesota care. The city is asking the state legislature for the same exclusions. With that, I'll conclude with my testimony and stand for questions alongside my colleague, Casey Weidrich.
All right, thank you very much. And we have Casey Weidrich. Did you want to testify or just for questions?
I believe she's on just for questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. I had her listed as a testifier, but that's just fine. So, all right. So are there questions from members? Okay. I'm not sure who was first. Let's go to first to Representative Quam and then Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, are there any ramifications to federal programs and guidelines that we'd have to get waivers for, so that we wouldn't cause participants to, not be able to qualify for other programs? That you understand what I'm saying about the federal waivers. Thank you.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. I'm actually going to direct that, if I can, to Mr. Carter Ramos, just to be absolutely sure that Representative Quam gets the right answer.
All right, that's great. And we do have someone here from DHS as well if we need their help. But Mr. Carter Ramos, please.
Mr. Carter Ramos, if you.
Oh, all right. Okay. Who do we have from DHS then?
Madam Chair?
Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, my name is Andrew Abertzese. I'm a policy specialist with the Department of Human Services. And just to the question about whether federal approval is required, we currently have a disaster relief spa or a state plan amendment that excludes these payments until the end of the emergency. If the program is still going on after the emergency ends, that would no longer apply. And for people with age blinders, disabled basis of eligibility, then we would need to seek additional federal approval through a standard state plan amendment.
Thank you. Don't go away here. Representative Quam, did you have a follow-up?
No, I just wanted to make sure that was touched upon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And could we talk? I'd like to hear a little bit more about the families that are enrolled in this program of the guaranteed income. I mean, my assumption is that they are low income families, that this is really having a big impact on their lives, and that little bit of, losing some of that would actually everything they would notice. So could you talk a little bit about the families?
Mr. Carter Ramos.
Madam Chair, Representative, families in terms of income status, everyone is below 300% of the federal poverty guideline. So everyone's low income family, the vast majority would be enrolled in public benefits. So that's broadly sort of the demographic on economics. In terms of who the families are, it's 100% of them are families with babies. They are younger families, and in the city of St. Paul, they're geographically dispersed across the city, and that's sort of the broader sort of demographic sort of profile.
Representative Pryor, any follow-up? Okay, thank you for that. Any other member questions? So we heard this bill in Human Services also, I believe. And so, I think it's, we've often talked in this committee about and in the other committee as well, and over the years in HHS, about how difficult it is for families to get on public benefits, how low they are, how many barriers there are. And so, you know, when people are in poverty, it's work to be in poverty, right? You don't to have to just think about, you know, where you're going to sleep every night, or how are you going to get food, or how are you going to take care of your most basic needs or the needs of your children. And I can only imagine to be really in poverty when you have young children in particular. This has got to be really even worse. So it's a really, I'm very interested in the experiment to see, you know, when you just take some of that stress off families by giving them this guaranteed income, what does it really do? Does it really improve the outcomes for the kids in particular during those really young years? And so I understand that what this is doing is trying to help you be able to do the experiment, because if we don't do this, then people will lose other benefits. And then it's like, no, there's no experiment there. That's how I'm understanding this, correct? So it's not a matter of wanting to, although maybe it is, give people money on top of what they've already got, but it's a matter of not having this, there just wouldn't be an experiment there if they're gonna, they might lose more than they gain if we don't do this kind of waiver. So am I, Mr. Karcher-Ramos, have I kind of explained this in a way that is correct?
Madam Chair, I think that's a great sort of synopsis of the intent of this, is how do you maintain, you know, and preserve the benefits that families are enrolled in while also letting this demonstration project and research study play out without, you know, having any unintended or adverse consequences, you know, on families, particularly, you know, looking at, you know, it's an 18-month, you know, demonstration project and research study. And our hope, of course, is that families can transition, you know, off of the public benefits and that, but for those families that may not, that it would be preserved, you know, during this time. And that is the real intent of the bill. So it's an accurate synopsis of what we're trying to do.
Great. And one little question, Mr. Karcher-Ramos, how is the legislature going to get the results of the study? What is that going to look like? And when would that be expected?
Madam Chair, we're working with the University of Pennsylvania. So they are our researchers on this study. And we have, you know, in the piece of legislation that a report will come back to the legislature, you know, when it is ready, probably 24 to 36 months from now.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much. And Representative Pinto, final word?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you so much for that summary of it. I totally agree. And I just wanted to note for members, if we were meeting in person, you'd have this in hand. But item number 10 in the attachments list is a really nice one-page summary of this put together by the city as well. And that may be helpful for members as well. It's number 10 and says cityofstpaul.pdf. And Madam Chair, thank you so much. And I really appreciate the way that you've described this. I completely agree. And thank you and members for hearing the proposal. Thanks
all
so
right.
much.
Thank you so much, Chair Pinto. So House File 1339 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Okay, we're going to go to Representative Morrison, House File 521. So Representative Morrison's motion that House File 521 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And I do... I'm sorry, I've got this a little backwards because this is coming to us from as a division report. So Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that the committee adopt the report of the Preventive Health Policy Division for HF 521.
All right, so this did receive a hearing in the Preventive Health Division. So, any discussion to the adoption of the report? Seeing none, if you'll unmute yourselves, members, all in favor of the adoption of the report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the report is adopted. And now it would be Representative Morrison's motion to have House Bill 521 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Morrison, I believe you also have an amendment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It is a technical amendment that removes a duplicative word.
Okay. All right. So Representative Morrison is moving the A1 amendment to House File 521. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And then members, as I said, this did have a complete hearing in the Preventive Health Division, but we do now have a fiscal note, which members received. It's unfortunate that we don't, you know, we're getting these, of course, as we get toward the deadlines and so on, we get these without a lot of time to read them, but it is before the committee. And I don't know, Representative Morrison, have you had an opportunity to read the fiscal note, and did you want to discuss it at all, or do you want to just kind of briefly, maybe just briefly present the bill and talk about the fiscal note if you care to do that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So very briefly, many of you will recall that House File 521 would extend Medicaid coverage to mothers for 12 months postpartum from the current federal mandate of 60 days, which is what we have in Minnesota. We have a mental health crisis, we have a substance use disorder crisis, and we have unacceptable racial disparities in maternal and infant outcomes in our state. We have to find a way to provide care for our new mothers during that very vulnerable first year. The fiscal note did come out today. And I have glanced at it. I have not been able to review it exhaustively, unfortunately. But it looks like, if I recall, this would apply to about 4,000 people a year. I don't know if Mr. Berg is on. He may be able to describe it in more
detail. I was just going to suggest that, Representative Morrison, you don't need to. If you've just had a fair chance to look at it like I have, let's ask Mr. Berg if he can walk us through the fiscal note briefly. And Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Morrison, I very high level, I you know, the number of cases it applies to is not something I have yet gotten in my mind. It is, I believe that Representative Morrison is right. If I'm looking at it, it is just under 4,000 monthly cases, I believe is the number. As I say, I've not read it in great detail myself either. The total cost as the bill stands now is about $9 million in the first biennium and about $29 million in ongoing in the tails. There may be ways to scale this benefit somewhat as well.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Mr. Berg. And does anybody, unless anybody has questions about the fiscal note, and I'm going to assume that most members haven't really had an opportunity to read it either, because it did just come and there's a lot of narrative in it, which is, you know, really interesting. Honestly, I got partway through it. And so this is certainly something that we'll have an opportunity to discuss again when members have had a chance, if there are questions about the fiscal note. So with that, anything else, Representative Morrison, that you wanted to see? Oh, I'm sorry. I do see we have a question from Representative Breyer, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I did have a question about the fiscal note. It's around the IT. And I guess my question to Mr. Berg is it typical for a change like this to really take an 11-month window and 20,000 hours of work? It seemed, you know, just based on my background in helping lead technology projects, those surprised me. I'll just leave it at that and wonder if that might be something to explore. There are some assumptions that or ways to implement the bill that could address that.
Mr. Madam Berg? Chair, the general topic of IT costs and DHS's and Minute's ability to implement them is an ongoing issue and has been for many years. It could be a whole topic for discussion of IT systems at DHS. They have many systems, which are often old legacy systems that are require a lot of work to change them. Broadly speaking, almost any change we make in benefit structure like this has IT costs related to it. It is not only common, it is to be expected at DHS. And delays or a longer time period of getting changes like this made are also frequent, I guess I would say, or common. It's they're in addition to just there are many changes that need to be made on an ongoing basis, and also there are the systems are difficult to work on, and so yes, this is an ongoing issue.
All right, and I understand that Sarah Orange is on the call and could maybe speak to this. Ms. Orange, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Welcome. Hey, Madam Chair, yes. Sarah Orange from DHS, thank you. To discuss particularly the extensive nature of the IT work, I'd actually defer to my colleague, Gina Savage, who's on the line as well.
Okay, Ms. Savage, welcome.
Madam, hi, this is Gina Savage. I am a healthcare policy analyst at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, for as Mr. Berg mentioned, anytime we touch our IT systems, there is going to be an IT cost. With this specific proposal, it would be extending the postpartum from 60 days into a year later. So we would have to go in and adjust that. When a woman is eligible as a pregnant woman, she is exempt from renewals. So anytime there's a renewal, so this proposal would affect renewals, which increases some of our IT lift. And then pregnant women are also exempt from income increases. So once a woman is determined eligible for MA as a pregnant woman, even if her income increases over the 278% threshold, she maintains her MA eligibility. So we also have to make sure that that is implemented across the entire 12 months. So not only are we touching the postpartum period, we're also touching our renewals functionality, our changes in circums functionality, as well as some of our notices. And then of course, any kind of interfaces and updates that we have to do on the coverage side as well. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Savage. Okay.
If I may, Madam Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Ryer.
Thank you. And I, of course, expect there to be IT costs, and I lived in a legacy world working in project management at Blue Cross. So, I know legacy systems, so I feel your pain. Just the kind of suggestion that struck me, though, is that, and this is an opportunity, not a criticism by any means, is that the language of the coverage is based on number of days, but coverage in the IT systems is based on months. And so doing days is much harder than months. So I would wonder to the author, could this be recast in terms of X number of months postpartum? And it's thinking about those types of things that can help make very little substantive change, but a lot easier from a technical perspective. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Ryer. As I read the note, I think that they made the assumption, they kind of did that conversion, but I don't know whether, I certainly hope that they'll reach out to the author if there are tweaks to the language that would help reduce the cost without reducing the impact on people. I certainly hope that they would step forward and help us with that piece. And I do have a question as well. And I'm not sure, I don't think this would be for Ms. Savage. This is more about the eligibility issues in the bill. And the fiscal note says, it talks about that actually only 20% of MA pregnant women are redetermined ineligible after the 60 days. but that a lot of the other women are moved to a different category of eligibility that is less expensive. So this was kind of news to me. So being a pregnant woman in that category is apparently more expensive than being what is it? It just goes from a pregnant woman to be an adult, I think. Maybe I've got that wrong, or parent, probably parent. And I'm just really interested in, you know, that just, obviously people, when they're pregnant, they need additional health care. But, in this postpartum category, I just wonder if the amount of care that they would need makes them so much more like pregnant women in terms of their expenses than it does as women, adults with children, I guess, if that's what it was in here. Is there anybody that can really address that kind of, is this because we're talking about managed care? Is that what this is about when you put them into the managed care system? What the capitation is for them based on this category? Is that what we're talking about here? Ms. Orange, can you answer that for me?
Madam Chair, I can certainly attempt to answer. So as you noted, the fiscal note assumes that a large proportion of these women would have remained covered even without this bill. They would have been redetermined as eligible in one of our programs and been shifted to most likely the parent eligibility basis. For the fiscal note, essentially what we did is we pulled claims data for women historically in our system that have been in that situation where they gave birth on our program and then were redetermined into a different eligibility category and pulled their actual claims to determine how much claims experience we actually have, how much we see them actually utilizing services. And so that's where we came up with, I believe it's an average of maybe $700 or $750 approximately per month that we're using as the basis of the fiscal note. And so that is somewhat higher than the average cap payment that we do see in terms of managed care in for the parent eligibility category. With that said, when this is implemented, obviously, to the extent that these folks do end up in a managed care plan with a managed care plan, and the rate setting process for managed care would look at actual data to determine kind of what the correct risk pool and what the correct capitation rate would be. And so for the purposes of the fiscal note, we merely looked at our old, our claims data to assess approximately what we think kind of these women's utilization would look like. And so it's an approximation on our part.
Okay, that's very helpful. And then, you know, since I'm asking these questions because we do have a few minutes, and I think we do have this really complicated fiscal note, which for something that seems so simple and intuitive, honestly, and the fiscal note so complex. But do we have any way? So the fiscal note is kind of assuming that many of these women will be in managed care. Right? Is that's kind of the assumption here. So what is there, and maybe this would be for the author too, what would their care look like? I mean, how would we assure under the bill? I mean, the bill is so, important to make sure that women get the kind of follow-up care that they need to reduce their risk of having a terrible event, to make sure that all these issues are dealt with during that first postpartum year. And even if we pay for this and put them in managed care, do we have any assurance that they'll actually get the care that they need to address these issues? Either because they're in a particular category, I don't know if that means there's a standard for what they get in terms of how many visits, or, you know, do you understand where I'm going, Representative Morrison? There's a little disconnect here, like, yes, we should pay for them to have care, but will they get the care?
Well, Madam Chair, I can certainly speak from clinical experience about that. And I think there's a growing realization in obstetrics and gynecology and internal medicine that women need probably more care. Many women need more care than they are getting in that first year postpartum. So we know that a third of maternal mortalities occur between a week and a year postpartum. And so, for example, if someone had a hypertensive complication during their pregnancy that continued past the 60 days postpartum, they would have nowhere to go other than an emergency room in a crisis after that period of time if their care, if their coverage expired. Whereas they could have a detailed care plan with their provider that would follow them throughout that year. If they had a history of a blood clot, if they had cardiac disease. Some people have, cardiac disease is now the number one cause of maternal mortality in the United States. So a detailed care plan could then be devised and followed, whereas now there's just this gigantic stop hole in their ability to receive care. And so the emergency room is kind of the only recourse. And then of course our struggles with substance use disorder and with mental health complications also require ongoing intensive care, and they don't, those people don't have access to that right now.
All right. Thank you. That's a really helpful answer, Representative Morrison. It's wonderful to have a member who's also a physician who probably delivers a lot of this care. So thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was fortunate enough to sit on also the Preventive Health Committee, and we did hear how important this bill was, and glad that we're hearing it again and discussing the fiscal impact of it. And if I can just keep kind of following up on the line I probably a misunderstanding, but I just want to make sure that this is kind of, that we can get this put together in the way that works for this group of women that we're trying to serve here. So on the one hand, it sounded like the description of it is that they'll be moved maybe from the fee for service into the managed care, insurance, and maybe I was misunderstanding that. But then my real question is, you know, however it works, as we're listening to Dr. Morrison, it seems like the people need to be followed by the same physician, and is that going to be possible the way that this is being written right now, and you know how their insurance coverage might be changing? Because if you're writing a care plan, you know, it should be that the same person that saw you through those first months when you were carried under one plan can continue to carry. And I think that is the intent of this, is a continuity of care. And now as we get into fiscal notes and assumptions made by DHS, is this going to happen the way that that at least we were talking about in preventive health, I guess?
Yeah, so thank you, Representative Pryor. I'm not sure if, we didn't really get what you just said about starting out fee-for-service and then moving to managed care. I'm not sure if that's the case. And I don't know, Ms. Orange, can you address that? I know I asked you whether they would be in managed care, but we didn't really talk about when a woman comes onto our programs because she's pregnant, how does that work? And can this be something where she can get continuity of care? She's not bumped from one program to another.
Yes, Madam Chair, Sarah Orange again. It's my understanding, and I want to preface this that I am not the managed care expert, but it's my understanding that most of these women are typically on managed care for the duration of their pregnancy period. And so I don't believe it's the situation where we'd see folks necessarily bumping back and forth between fee-for-service and managed care, is my understanding.
Okay. Does that help, Representative Pryor? Yeah. Okay. Well, very good. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm glad we were able to get the fiscal note, even if we didn't have much time to review it. And I'm sure members will be interested in it now because it really does these oftentimes fiscal notes are really the way to learn a lot about the way things work in our programs. And if you read them, their narratives especially, you do learn a lot. So thank you so much, Representative Morrison, for bringing this bill. And so this House file, let's see, what's the number? House file 521 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So we are almost done here today. I'll just mention what we've got on tap for tomorrow. We are hearing several bills about hospitals. And one from Representative Lippert. There is also a major amendment posted to that, which I would ask everyone to look at, which is a related bill from Representative Fisher. So please do take a look at that. And then a bill from Representative Herr, House File 834, which is a request for additional hospital licenses for Regents Hospital. And then I have House File 1609, which is a request from Hennepin County Medical Center for a change in their financial situation. And we'll look forward to having them explain that because it's a complicated bill. So if there is no other business before the committee, thank you everybody for your attendance today, and we stand adjourned.